never call yourself a writer, just be writing. It's impossible to know where the truth starts and the lying stops, because you don't know, is this the bottom of the lies, or am I just at a new layer of it? When you do boil down the Renaissance, it was like these select people doing it. It was an individualistic pursuit. Anybody can train when they're motivated. Let that pass by and try and focus on the universal and the timeless.
This is Audience of One, and I'm your host, Spencer Keir.
My guest today is Dylan O'Sullivan. He's a curator, editor, and writer. Dylan and I talk about writing, taste, discipline versus inspiration, timelessness versus ephemerality, boredom and solitude versus the internet, inciting a digital renaissance, not lying to yourself, and more. Please enjoy.
I don't know if you're officially or unofficially now, since I never record or never actually publish the episode, but you're my first repeat guest. Something you and I have kind of danced around over DMs before, which I'll ask a little bit more directly here, is whether you view yourself as kind of a curator slash critic slash editor of literature, or are you a writer yourself? And some amount of this is you need to make ends meet. You have 9 to 5, you have responsibilities to help other people in kind of the editing capacity as well as a curation capacity. But would you put yourself in that first bucket of curator, critic, editor, or are you a writer, or is the latter just aspirational as of now?
I would say writer. Even though, you know, quote unquote, as I get Faulkner quote, as I could never call myself a writer, just be writing. And I haven't been doing too much of the latter in the last, like, I've done a lot in the past. I just wrote for like places like The Spectator and stuff like that. But, and I have my own blog and I've done some stuff. In academia, you're writing all the time. But in the last 8 months or so, yeah, I've been kind of pouring all my creative juices into other people in the editing capacity. But that gets very blurry as well, because what we're doing over there is quite creative. It's a lot of back and forth, idea bashing. It's not copy editing. So I would say, like, this style of editing that we're doing is far closer to writing than, let's say, copywriting would be, or some journalism perhaps would be, in terms of like the creative input and the creative toll it takes. So you kind of, it does check some of the same boxes psychologically as if you were writing. You kind of get that horror and pain, and then satisfaction after the fact. It's much the same as, like, you know, going for a long run or going to the gym. But then, yeah, long term, definitely want to write books of my own. So I kind of look at everything as honing different parts of the craft, because editing is half of writing anyway, perhaps 2/3, perhaps 7/8. So the better you can get at that, then the better you can kind of turn it back on yourself once that blade is sharp.
Yeah. So maybe the label co-author slash editor is a bit more accurate at this point. And obviously you're honing skills, as you said, that'll inevitably be used when you do decide to kind of step on the gas and write more yourself. What is
I'll have to push back on co-author just for the fact that the authors themselves are there. And I'm not in the idea generation phase from, like, you know, starting from a blank page. That's been all then. So I still don't know if I can do. Yeah. Cause I've been working mostly up pretty much all on fiction. So I don't even know if I could do that. I've never tried to start from zero on a narrative and then build from there, which they have. So I get to come in when the hard part's done to some degree. So there is that.
So when will you start writing in earnest on your own stuff, and what's the blocker? If the primary blocker is just these obligations to help other people in this editing capacity, how and when will you take that next step to officially become a writer, or I guess do more writing, as Faulkner would say?
So a lot of it is as I get better at editing, because I'm kind of diving into fiction for the first time, and it's like full into books straight away. So I'm kind of like, you know, it's that technique where you just throw a baby in the pool when they're like 1 year old, and then they just, like, you know, they're kind of do it by instinct. But it's there's no stroke developed, so they're not making any distance or speed. And so once I can start to get a handle on that and become more, because I'm definitely not efficient now, because I have really high standards, so I know where I need to get it. It just takes me ages to get there, so it's like late nights in that respect. But as I get better at doing that, then hopefully there'll be hours carved out during the day that I can kind of put that energy to. Because right now, at the end of the day, with what I'm doing, I'm wiped, because as I get it, it's using a lot of the same part of your brain as writing does. Then trying to turn on something of your own after that, you're just like, not that that part of me is already used up completely at that point.
Yeah, you need those times of the day where you can invest 100% of your energy into your own work, or else it's just gonna languish. I want to harp on this a bit more. Is there a reservation on your behalf as to your ability? Because you touched on this concept of like the taste gap has come up a number of times on the podcast. Like you, especially as a curator, in my opinion, around like literature, you have arguably the best account in terms of curating high quality snippets, excerpts, or even full books. And so you've developed this taste, this eye for really high quality work. But then obviously it takes years, decades, or maybe in some cases, people don't ever get there to have your own work match that quality that you have an eye for. So is that a big part of your reservation on jumping into writing sooner than later? Or is it purely the kind of financial and obligatory side of things? Do you have a fear as a writer that your work won't live up to the quality that you see in these kinds of these greats you aspire to?
I think anyone who says otherwise is lying. To be honest, like, you know, even like the greatest writers, you would say, have no power, had their idols growing up who they felt that they never reached the heights of. And they were never really happy with their own work afterwards. Only a few, like, you know, people with like huge egos, like Gore Vidal or something, like there's like, you count them on one hand, who was actually like, you know, fully satisfied post finishing the work. But yeah, so there's definitely some of that right now. It is the time and energy thing, but there is 100% perfectionism thing. That is a bug in the back of your brain. There's also the thing where, going back to honing the skills, that you can kind of perpetually put it off, because you just say, okay, if I just get a little bit better, then right, the book will be a bit better. But that never stops, because you'll never perfect that. So you can keep honing and honing and honing and honing and then die before you've ever actually had the chance to kind of wield it in any capacity. So that's something that I've become cognizant of in recent years, because it's kind of bug has been with me since I was like 17, 18, or 28 now. So I realized, okay, I could, from let's say 18 to 26, when I was constantly just trying to get better before I started, I realized at about 26, okay, I could do this forever and not have anything done to show for it. Realizing that, I think, is the first step. Yeah.
Yeah. Is there a milestone or a time-related kind of deadline you're imposing on yourself at which you need to start, come hell or high water, like you need to start writing, you need to get something out there? Or is it more of a feeling that you're waiting for, some kind of like, whether it is a stroke of kind of creativity that says, okay, this is the thing I should be like working on, channeling my effort into, or it's just you hit some point where internally you say, okay, it's time to actually invest in this. What will be the turning point for you?
Well, 30 is certainly one. That's in what
I've seen you mention that elsewhere on Twitter. So that was, partially where the question was coming from.
It's like 20 months, 19 months away. So that's a bit tight, but to certainly have started for, at that point, would be enough, I think, not to, you know, render that benchmark as a failure. I think a lot of it is like, I'm not the most routined person. I will often just go through the night and then, you know, it's suddenly it's 4 p.m. from the, and it's like I've not stepped outside since 4 p.m. the previous day, and then I sleep. So, but then you end up losing time when you do that, because you don't get to maximize these pockets that you can craft when you're sticking yourself to a proper schedule. So recently I started sleeping like an adult and forcing myself to go to bed at like, you know, 12 a.m. at the latest. And as I've actually, only the last couple of months, because it was getting a bit out of hand, where there could be sometimes two nights in a row, you just go and then you sleep for like, you know, 22 hours and then you're just like, okay, I'm living alone so I can get away with it. But it's like, okay, this is just not feasible for any kind of life that's in contact with the outside world. So when I do kind of slip into that pocket and I realize I do have these pockets of time and I do potentially have the kind of creative juices to do something, and I feel myself just skipping by that, and that'll be more where, okay, no, I can actually start plugging into those now and start just getting some black on white on a regular basis.
Why do you think it sounds like you're saying you need a bit more discipline, or you need to carve out time explicitly for doing this. You need to create some kind of habit. Why is that necessary as opposed to working off of inspiration whenever it might strike, or a little more in a more disjointed or less reliable way?
Yeah, well, there's something to be said for both. Well, to be honest, it's just I've done the latter, the disjointed, and I hasn't been material. Now I've started a new job. I'm kind of pouring everything of myself into that. So like that to correspond to that. So that's just kind of plugging up every gap. But yeah, no, there are two schools of thought. There's the Paul Schrader. I saw him on a podcast recently. He wrote Taxi Driver, and he just said, yeah, it was like, you know, caffeine, nicotine, cocaine, go from 10 at night.
The Hunter Thompson routine.
Yeah, basically, yeah. And then you have people like, oh God, I can't remember his name. He was an English author from the early 20th century, but he just did something like, it was like 250 words a day. If he finished a book on word 240, he would do the first 10 words of the next book. So he was like, just like that militant about it. And he would work full time as a postman. Damn, I can't remember his name. He was, even though it's a little bit, it's not much. He wrote like tens and tens and tens of novels. And then, you know, some people that, you know, they burn brightly quickly. Those are the inspiration based people. But then that often doesn't sustain itself. And then, you know, the life itself can get away from you, and then you can end up dying at 41 or something like that. So then, you know, no matter how prolific you were in those years, you've halved your life. So how much could you have done with the remainder of that if you hadn't burned out?
This is the exact line of thinking that goes through my head when I think about, I don't have a particular, this podcast is more for fun than anything else. I've thought about getting back into writing like I did in high school and early college. And when I think about trying to become prolific in that, this is the exact kind of conversation that goes through my head is, well, I feel like there are moments where I feel more inspiration and that's what I should lean into. But then what if I don't have inspiration? Well, I need more structured time to be able to at least crank out some amount of words to get some kind of momentum. And so there's this like back and forth with these trade-offs to each approach that I always struggle with. And in the meantime, I end up just not writing. So maybe I'm missing the whole plot, but that's kind of the origin of the question. I was curious how you approach that.
And there's a parallel with all things. I've seen, like, you know, Chael Sonnen says, like, you know, anybody can train when they're motivated. That's not when it's hard. And you get, like, you know, the steroid bro aphorisms, like, you know, it's the day you train when you didn't want to is worth three of when you did, all those kind of things. But it's true. It is true.
I haven't heard that Chael Sonnen quote. That's great. That might be the answer. Yeah. It might be the you need the discipline to at least have that baseline, but then when the moments of inspiration strike as well, I mean, lean into them if it's a bit more effortless and frictionless.
I think it was inspiration is for amateurs. Yeah, maybe I said that already, but that's a quote from maybe it's Stephen Pressfield, something like that. So again, it is the regimen, and even like, you know, people like, you know, superficially bombastic, like Hemingway, who was like, you know, drinking, fishing, fighting all the time. He had like, you know, above his writing desk, he wrote standing up, and he had just a cardboard sheet with the week's words. So he tried to hit 500 a day, nothing more. Some days then he'd hit 3, and then the next day he'd do 8. If he was going out drinking on the weekend, he would make sure he got his weekend words done during the week. So he would like, you know, he would almost bank it. And, you know, he's one of the most erratic people you could possibly imagine. But that's what he said. He said, you should treat it like a soldier, or like a clergyman. Like it should be something, like it should be ritual craft. And again, going back to that word discipline, even though it's kind of been beaten around in all domains all the time, but yeah.
For a reason.
So yeah, that is one. Yeah. For a reason. Exactly. Yeah. The truisms are true.
Right. Yeah. One of the things that I have to imagine complicates trying to write in the current day and age is, especially for somebody like yourself who is very online like me, and in your case, some amount of the development of kind of your personal brand and your audience is this curation that we alluded to earlier. You have to spend a few hours a day at least online, engaging, posting. How do you balance some amount of your time being spent with kind of these timeless works and needing to spend hours to really get through them, make sense of this, both for your personal benefit, but then also to curate more material for your audience versus having to find that time when you're cut off from the internet, just focused on right now, it might be the editing we talked about, but in the future, it'll be your own writing. How do you stroke or how do you find the balance between those two?
I don't find the balance. It's just that I don't do anything else. So like I, again, pretty solitary here, pretty secluded. Get up at 8 a.m. I'll go to the gym, come back, have a coffee by like 9, half 9. And then I'm just here until 12 a.m. So you can do everything when you live like that.
Right.
Now, this is what I've been, because again, new job, et cetera. This is just what I've been doing because I've been here. So it's kind of aligned for me well, because I could kind of put my all in. Not, again, going back to burning out, not sustainable from a social standpoint or a general quality of life standpoint. But for me, I'm kind of like, I'm not being facetious, where I don't get lonely ever. I've never felt that. And when I'm with people, I love it. And I love going drinking and, you know, going out, going mad, but being alone, perfectly fine. Months on end is fine. It doesn't really bother me, again, because I have one of those hobbies where it's like books and writing. And even when you things like Twitter, you can just dive into that kind of stuff. So I don't balance at all. It's just all of them at the same time.
It's a very honest take. And yeah, I think it's something we are kind of talking about this at the beginning, but as you have a family, as you have kids, as you have other responsibilities, you have to make sacrifices on particular areas of your life that you've been able to allow to be like a bit more expansive and take up more of your time. How do you think about in the future? It sounds like you want to have a family, want to have kids. How do you think about trying to find the balance between that and the artist's life, which is one, or tends to be one, if they're quote unquote more successful or prolific, that's more of solitude and about the art?
Yeah, so that kind of ties into the both things, where first of all, getting way better, so you can do things way more efficiently and quicker, and just, you know, reach that standard in a far straighter line than you otherwise would. I'm kind of like, you know, even though I have no real reason to, like, you know, leave the disjointed life for the disciplined one now, I've kind of forced myself into that already, because I'm okay, you kind of you can't just begin that road when you get there. There has to be some kind of foundation laid beforehand. So doing things like that, and, you know, kind of practicing being able to turn it on as well, you know, so you've 30 minutes, fine, just go. Okay. You don't need to, right now I can have like, you know, an hour lackadaisical build up to when I do an hour, but it'd be cool to just jump into that hour, which I've started doing a little bit by just getting up in the morning and just sitting down at my computer and just working, just to kind of stretch that muscle. It was a cool thing that happens, but you're kind of working, you enter kind of a, because your conscious brain isn't fully woken up. So you're kind of on this, like Arthur Koestler called it, like a marshy shore between sleep and full awakening. So ego is quiet, the world is quiet, and then all of a sudden you kind of like come to, and you've been working for 45 minutes and you've kind of not even realized, and you're kind of just only kind of fully waking up now. So I found that really fruitful. So to be able to kind of slick into that state at all periods of the day, which is, you know, possible through things like meditation and kind of subjecting yourself to, like, you know, prolonged silence, leaving the earphones at home when you go for a walk, all these different types of things. You can kind of, because I think you actually do, you have to build your life around that. I think it has to be like, it all has to feed in. If you want to be great, if you want to be good, right, you can kind of like, you know, schlock away and you can kind of make it happen.
You had a childhood with a lot of intentional boredom. Didn't have video games, I think, through your teens, or at least through part of your teens. Like I said, you were homeschooled. How much do you feel like your upbringing has allowed you to be more content with the solitude and the kind of environment that is conducive with creative work? And I guess to kind of the other end of that question, how might you think about manufacturing boredom as like a teenager or somebody in their 20s nowadays, when there is so much stimulation and opportunity to distract yourself from the work?
So I think literally all of it is that childhood, and I fought against it with all my might at the time. Yeah. Couldn't understand. All my friends were allowed to watch unlimited TV, and I was the one weirdo who wasn't. But no, honestly, now in hindsight, then it's like, couldn't be, because I think that is that kind of a superpower that I had nothing to do with. It was like their kind of plotting and their kind of Stalin-esque approach to all things ephemeral, really. So yeah, being forced outside, kind of not even forced to read, but, you know, they were clever enough. They'd like, you know, just put them in a room with books and no screens, and it'll kind of happen naturally. And that's what did. With regard to people now, yeah, it's, even though I'm not that old, so I was like, what? It was like early 2000s. So like phones are pretty prevalent. Internet was coming on. Social media wasn't quite there. It was there when I was like 13, 14. But when I was, you know, put out in a, you know, put in a boredom square for a few hours on end, you kind of just have to come up with ways to be creative, and you're kind of just turning your imagination up to nine because you've no other alternatives. But now I think with people, with kids, like they have to turn their motivation up to nine just to get away from the screen before they even thought about being creative. So to even just to get to the boredom phase, they have to do, like, if their parents aren't, you know, almost coercive with it, they put in all this work just to get to a phase that I was there by default, and that pretty much every kid was there by default up to, I don't know, 90s, maybe sometimes, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, it's easy kind of just to kind of blame the TikTok gen and stuff, but it's like, I think it's 10 times harder. And then, you know, each year, the age that kids gets phones gets younger. So like, I was like, maybe 13, is that going to secondary school is a thing now? You can see, like, you know, kids 9, 8, and things like that. So the milieu that you're in can make that almost impossible. I think it's a parenting thing. But also because of the milieu and the social forces, it's harder for the parents as well to enforce that, because it's becoming weirder and weirder to make your kid the one without the phone. And they're going to, like, probably fight back harder. I don't know. The prognosis is probably not great. But for those that do it, then the upside is just going to be so much taller.
Right. And that's the having a 2.5-year-old and another on the way, I think about how it is possible to cultivate an environment that properly marries technology and the internet with what I'll call more proven ways of getting what you want from a creative standpoint. You just can't be constantly enmeshed in consuming. You will have no time or space for that output. And so it's an incredibly challenging environment to raise a kid unless you do intentionally kind of remove them from those external social forces, like you homeschool, like you were. To some extent, maybe you have to be out in a more rural setting, but inevitably they're going to get access to the internet. They're going to get access to technology. It's how we communicate. It's how we work. I'm a bit of a hypocrite if I say my kid shouldn't have access to any technology when that's what's enabling me to do my 9-to-5. It's what enables us to have this conversation. So I have no kind of surefire heuristics or like compass when it comes to this is the appropriate way to implement technology. And I think the other factor here is it's continually evolving too. Like there's we're constantly on the precipice of new technology and innovation that you then have to figure out how to incorporate that even when it's in an unproven state. So I don't know. This is something all parents, I think, are going to have to figure out. I do want to ask a follow-up question on your point about like that this is the milieu. What impact do you see that continuing to have on the types of content and types of form factors we see? I'll call them artistic kind of mediums. Do you see a pendulum swing back to folks are trying to be more, trying to seek out boredom more, trying to seek out solitude more in hopes of creating these kind of longer form works? Or do you think we continue to just swing towards shorter and shorter types of formats? Effectively, what's the impact, long-term impact, do you think this is going to have on artistic mediums?
Yeah, well, I don't think it's working, number one, as it is. So that's going to necessitate a pendulum swing at some point because the viewers won't stand for it. The readers won't stand for it. There'll be a little bit of a frog in boiling water effect where some will just get dragged. Like, you know, you don't know. You'll forget how good it was in 2010 and you'll forget how good it was in 2020 and gradually go down. But there'll be those who can kind of like, you know, those, follow the old stuff, dive into the old stuff that we'll remember. So it'll probably be more of a decentralized thing, to use another overwrought word, where it'll be pockets. And again, how publishing is breaking up, streaming to an extent kind of has a stranglehold a little bit, but even that's breaking up into like 10 different ones. It'll probably be indie streamers at some point. As well, like, you know, like even places like A24, I can see them branching off, doing their own thing there once they get big enough. So there'd be kind of a place for all things, kind of like it was before. And there was kind of a period, kind of, it was a monoculture, you know, with just the three channels. And then stuff started with the early internet, stuff started splintering, but then it kind of seemed, it's kind of like it kind of seemed to converge on both sides. It kind of seemed to all kind of filter back in to one again in the last, like, you know, five, ten years or so. But I think it's just going to branch off, just because you can see, like, you know, even Marvel fans aren't happy with Marvel. So, like, you know, that's kind of a sign that something is going to change. And the penny has dropped in places like stand-up comedy, where you see, you know, I don't even know if Comedy Central is still like a channel that you can get anymore, but they basically abandoned that, went straight onto YouTube, did so much success there that Netflix is having to fork out, like, you know, $30, $40 million deals just to get them back on the streamer, even though they just gave it away for free before. And they just decided to make all their money touring. But now even, like, you know, big comedy is coming back around. Yeah. So the artists will kind of, and, you know, self-publishing is doing well. There'll be indie publishers like us that break out. because the attic, there's just kind of just a dead whale that's kind of just being waiting to break apart and like and new things to break forth. Yeah.
I went and saw Dune 2 the other day, and this might turn us down a Denny rabbit hole, but we'll see. And I couldn't help but notice, although I think I had like subconsciously already seen this, I couldn't help but notice the number of previews, the number of trailers that were either spinoffs, a part of a franchise, adaptions. There's very few original works nowadays. And Dune 2 was great. Happy it was made. But I think we need far more original works. Is this a misunderstanding on my part about like the history of film? Actually, this has always been kind of the distribution of films between like original and I'll call them remakes or spinoffs. And if not, what do you think is, what are the environmental factors that are leading to kind of this low risk environment within film?
Yes and no, you're not wrong at all. It's like when you look at like either highest grossing, you can look at award shows, and then you look at the quotient of original screenplays or original series, and it's just falling off the cliff. Like in the 90s, everything was new. Like, you know, like Fight Club, Good Will Hunting, all these kind of original screenplays, often written by like, you know, relative nobodies sometimes. Like, you know, you could just write a script and get up there. But now it's completely changed. Again, it's completely de-risked. So yeah, but there's sort of cowardice on the side of the movie industry, which is, it's become just suits. You know, the suits are in control. And they are suits because, you know, they didn't follow the artistic, filmmaking, creative, whatever you want to call it, path growing up. So obviously, they, you know, they have the most say with the least to say.
On that note, really quickly, I hadn't, and then I'll let you fish for that second comment. I hadn't made this connection before, but I had Rory Sutherland on the podcast, and he made this excellent point about the amount of control that like the financialization and kind of operational class has, or like departments within organizations, within corporations, and that's a very constraining on the creative class. And I can't help but see the connection between those two. And it may be simply like you're saying that when you're modeling all of this, when you're doing forecasting, when you're in a spreadsheet day in, day out, when you're living by the data, you're going to be less prone to take risks like this on new work. And so it raises the question of how do we kind of reverse this? Do we need, like, how do you dethrone those individuals who are in control of the budgets? Or do we not work through the existing institutions and we need, you know, maybe it's A24 or whoever kind of spins out and proves out a different model that leads with the creative?
Yeah. So it's really interesting that I can't remember where I saw it. And I don't know if it sounds true. I think it is true that it's like, it seems money and cinema, they seem to be kind of like polar opposites in a sense. So in the beginning of the 70s, when you'd upstarts like Coppola and Scorsese and all these guys, they basically had free reign. They were doing all kinds of weird, you know, again, original movies. That wouldn't necessarily have been, you know, guaranteed to make any money whatsoever, let alone become like, you know, all time classics. And then all of a sudden, once they started getting buzz, money poured in because they say, oh, this is working. And then you get the 80s, which was like a relative cliff compared to the 70s. And then when the money came in, that didn't work. So then the money left, and then you got the 90s, which is another like peak. And then 90s work, money comes back in, and then it seems like we've been like in a 25-year peak now. Even though I would say it seems to be like the late 2000s, it seemed to really take a dive. Especially, and you can just look at comedies because it's the most risky. And then, you know, get anyone to name their top 10 comedies, and then tell him check the year. It's like, it's probably, 2016. It's like, no, it's 2004.
It's 20 years
ago. And then
ago.
You basically, at about 2009, it just collapses. They were making like 5-6 blockbuster cinemas everywhere, comedies a year. Well, way more, like 5-6 great ones that like people still watch today a year, up until like 2010. And then it's just radio silence.
Yeah, it seems like the budget has significantly shifted towards action that's a little more, that fits more easily into a globalized scale. Like you look at, Fast and Furious, easy just to throw that on a screen in China and not worry about the dialogue, mm-hmm. as opposed to something that's a little bit more dialogue heavy is going to be difficult to translate, therefore less financially viable. But it also sounds like there might be hope in the sense that it seems to be cyclical, like through your analysis. So we're due for a pendulum swing.
Yeah, I'm thinking that then we kind of talked about the downsides of some tech, especially for kids, but like the upsides of tech where you got people like, okay, someone filmed like a movie on their iPhone. It was like a pretty established director. I can't remember which one it was.
Yeah.
And the price of making a movie should collapse with, for good and bad. Some of the actors won't be happy, but there's like the things like AI around the corner. But even just like, mm-hmm. flat screen DVDs, like, $200 today was like, $4,000 like in the early 2000s when they came out. So like that's going to happen with like, camera equipment. All that kind of thing is going to make rogue indie filmmakers and filmmaking just way more possible. And you're just going to have a far wider spread, which is kind of, I think, what's necessary.
I think this conversation is a microcosm of a larger topic that I know you're really interested in. I've become more interested in recently, which is the kind of opportunity for and the circumstances or the environmental factors through which we cultivate kind of like a new renaissance, a digital renaissance. And so two questions, although would leave it open-ended to kind of just riff on this wherever you want. Is it to question kind of the underlying premise, can you even actively spark a new renaissance, or is it something that's far more emergent and visible in hindsight? And if we can spark it, if you do disagree with that, what should we be doing? Or what would you point to and say, we're doing something promising over here. Let's do more of that.
Yeah. So I never really believe in the macro of things, because when you do boil down the Renaissance, it was like these select people doing it. It was an individualistic pursuit. And then those individuals can inspire each other. And then there's kind of this meta thing that it's like, you play some notes individually and then there's like a melody on top. So then the melody on top is the Renaissance and we can kind of look back at that and it looks like one cohesive whole. But they probably didn't even see that at the time. They probably thought themselves either in awe or in, vicious rivalry with one another. And then that kind of leads to some kind of holistic thing on top. What we need to do, I think a big problem, and I saw a tweet, I'd love to shout him out, but I can't remember, is like the Renaissance wasn't this like, future focused, EAC type project. It was, I was reading actually today, I was going back over some notes I had in the book, From Dawn to Decadence by Jack Burzon. It's a history book. And he says that the Renaissance, they saw Greece through Roman eyes. So, they were kind of, situated in their present. And then they started looking back to the wisdom of antiquity and said, okay, so how can we pick up these pieces and combine them with the kind of emerging tech, which was revolutionary. You kind of had like, the scientific method with Bacon, et cetera, just kind of breaking out of the scene. So they could do so much more than what the Greeks could with the tools they had at hand, basically. You have like, emergence of like, printing and all this stuff. They weren't like, stabbing rocks, trying to like, preserve things into antiquity, et cetera. And I think we're not doing that at all. I think, there's like a demonization of the canon. You kind of have the post-structuralist thought where, any kind of generic storytelling, beginning, middle, and end, heroes and villains, all that kind of stuff is gauche and cliche. And instead, we're just going to do like, you know, a stream of conscious novel for 1800 pages about some depressed, you know, teen, you know, people going through their existential angst or something like that. And that's fine. There's probably, there is a place for that as well. But when that becomes all there is, and it's, again, it's tied into this ever narrowing present as well. And that's the tweet that I saw today that I wanted to get back to, is that the half-life of novels has gotten so much, like, you know, no one cares about what last year's best, so they're already dead, even though 1961 bestsellers are still read, and then 2023 bestsellers are gone. You know, maybe, you know, they, no one's going to read them in 5 years. Is it because they're trying to attach themselves and explain the present, which is already, it's dying as you're explaining it, because the rate of acceleration has gotten so quick? And again, and that's like, you know, the opposite of what people like Shakespeare did, where, like, you know, Shakespeare, like, immediately goes and, you know, writes about, you know, Caesar. He just jumps way back. He writes it in, like, in modern language, and he weaves those kind of particular nuances of and contemporary themes into it. But it's built to last. He doesn't wrap it up in these kind of, like, surface level social issues that are always changing. So, you know, they're immediately kind of out of date. It's like, you know, if you see in films when they try and, like, represent even social media on a movie, if they did that in 2008, you look at, you're laughing at the screen, because those types of things just don't translate. They don't last. So you're kind of, it's like an ephemeral art, as opposed to what, like, people like Hemingway said, did rather, that he was, like, in a war against time. He said he was, like, he was trying to find this fifth dimension above poetry and prose that would, like, you know, withstand the test of time even longer than either of those forms. So, like, I don't think people are even thinking about that now. They're just thinking about, okay, get this deal, get this out. Do they even think about their own book, you know, 2 or 3 years later, or they're kind of just embrace that churn mindset where it's like, you know, if you get canceled, they say to you, just don't apologize. Like Drake has that thing where he says, you know, 72 hours, just stay out. 72 hours gone. Yeah. There's something else. Someone else fucked up. Something else has happened. There's another war outbreak. You just need to outlast that. So I think that's feeding into everywhere, and I think art included.
Seems like a massive problem to try to, I guess, first just to make sense of, but second to broach in terms of, like, a solution, if you can even architect one. It sounds like the ingredients.
Yeah, it's not hard, because it's going back to the Renaissance thing. It's just individuals can do it.
So you think it's more grassroots? It doesn't need to be a top-down orchestration of something.
It's a macro kind of negative force and difficulty, but you can plug out. Most people won't plug up, but the individuals then who do will just be, you know, leaps and bounds. That's where you see people like, you're like, you know, Tarantino is so rare now, because he hasn't, like, kind of blended in whatsoever. He's just remained Tarantino. Herzog has remained so. So those few who either remain what they, because they kind of have gotten a bit easier because they kind of predated the flux that we're kind of in now. But it'll just be some kind of individual people who kind of check out, you know, go get lost in the mountains for 2 years and do their own thing, and, like, literally let that pass by and try and focus on the universal and the timeless. Then if they can come back with something, whether it be a book or a movie or anything like that, it'll just be, you know, it should skyrocket, because there's a thirst for it as well. Because, like I said, I don't think audiences aren't happy.
And yet there's an element, there's a phrase that I've been thinking a lot about over the past few months, which is focus on what's timeless and what might become timeless. And I think we're, especially with the rise of AI recently, like, this isn't something that's going away. It's not yet timeless, because it's only been, you know, a few years of people, of it being in kind of the mainstream consciousness. but it is going to be around indefinitely. How do you think about merging or bridging that which is timeless to that which is emergent in a way that isn't so ephemeral? Because I don't, yes, you can continue to tell stories. You know, there's a handful of underlying stories that have existed throughout the beginning of humanity. We're just telling them in different ways. That's great. Continue to tell those. But there's also something like really important happening here on the futuristic front that I don't think you can just ignore entirely. So how should you seek to kind of merge those two, if at all? Or do you disagree with the premise? Just purely focus on what's timeless.
That's a good question. Again. Well, there's an idea of form, which I find really interesting. So if, I'm going to phrase it. So if you have like you have a container and you have a thing contained, okay? So then if you make the container out of what's timeless and you have a thing contained, which is the particulate in the middle, like, you know, this can be like, you know, even characters' names and stuff, like all these like surface level details can change. When those things change, if they're not the fundamental, if they're not the foundations of what you're building, those things can change. Like we don't get thrown off when we go back in Shakespeare and we're kind of reading about some kind of like, you know, monarchical social dynamics, because it's the grand things like, you know, love, treachery, and those literal, like, you know, the five act structure. He's kind of underlaid the particular, because his stuff was like, you know, cutting edge contemporary as well, but it's which part of it you make contemporary. But then if you have like, you know, novels that are kind of just, you know, using internet culture and the ephemerality of that as like how they're structuring their book and as like the main force, like, you know, the internet will be different next week. So you've kind of, instead of, it's like, you know, you can either build a wooden house on a rock foundation or you can do the opposite and the wood's going to rock, basically. So then you have to combine the two, because if you created a perfectly timeless story structure and then you went back in time and then you kind of did these kind of like, you know, knights and dragons and you pour away all the content, no one read it because it's just kind of boring and it's been done. So you need to combine the two. But it's which takes precedence and which is like, you know, your foundation and which is your structure.
Right. And the people who are building for the ephemeral, you're saying, are flipping those at the moment, that thus leading to their quicker half-life.
Yeah. Like if you write a novel about like, you know, Tumblr culture.
Right.
Tumblr's gone. Well, it's not gone, but it's like, you know, it's
definitionally no longer, can't stand the test of time.
And how can they, 12-year-old now who never saw Tumblr, if it's about Tumblr as like, you know, thematically, tonally, and characterologically, there's no plug-in. There's no like, you know, kids have felt like, you know, love and treachery and stuff. Like, you know, they can plug into those things. They can't plug into something that, you know, is just kind of a wisp of civilization that's kind of long gone.
With this in mind, as you think about starting to do your own original works over the next year or two, whether it is a book, or I know you're fascinated by screenplays as well, that's something you want to do, if not in the near term, eventually. What are the kind of stories you're fascinated in and want to be telling through your own work that you think are timeless? And whether that's, you could give us a glimpse into the plot of something you're ruminating on, or more general strokes, topics, themes.
Yeah. So, well, that's begging the question of whether it'll be fiction in the first place when I do go into book. I'm not sure it will be. I think I come from academia, so well, I was there for a long time. I don't come from there.
Doesn't have to be fiction to. Even with within nonfiction, you can either discuss the timeless or you can discuss the last 5 years of social media effects on X. So what are those topics or those themes that you want to cover in your own work?
Oh, yeah, I definitely lean almost exclusively towards the timeless in those things. Yeah.
But what in now, what in particular?
Again, if I was doing fiction, I would find ways to balance it, because I think you need to. But with nonfiction, you know, nonfiction, you literally have history. You don't have to do that. And I am interested in like the grander things, like the subconscious origins of creativity, dynamics therein, all these types of things. And you can touch upon, it's actually important to like, you know, and some of it will, of course, be out of date. It's just a matter of how much, like if you're doing a book on creativity, which is something I want to do at some point, you're going to have to touch upon like, you know, the latest literature, like the latest science, all of this stuff, even though you're kind of almost kicking yourself, because you know, with all like these replication crises, et cetera, it's like, fuck, is this even like, you know, am I standing on, I'm not a scientist, am I even standing on solid ground now? So you kind of want to use that stuff sparingly. But then you go back and you read loads of like similar kind of nonfiction books that dive into all types of things. Like Nietzsche makes loads of psychological statements. But he kind of, they're kind of like, you know, he pulls like the generalities from things, so they kind of stand true. So I think you can do that with it, with any form. So yeah, definitely leaning towards the timeless as much as possible, which is why with essay, well, that's kind of what I'm trying to do as well. It's like,
yeah,
diving into like what I did with Hemingway. It was like, I wanted this to like, you know, 12 months reads exactly the same. You get just as much out of it, 24 months, 36 months. So that's kind of how I didn't even make that decision consciously. I was like, I don't want to do something that's irrelevant in 12 months. Cause I'm just putting my time into it. So why? I want something, yeah, especially with like, you know, the quote unquote permanence of the internet. I want it to stay there.
Yeah, that's the paradox of the internet, I suppose, the ephemerality and yet the eternal storage of it. No, I had no question in my mind that you'd be focused on the timeless. I think it was more so a question about what in particular. And I think the subconscious, the origins of creativity, sounds like is the answer to that. So I'm fascinated to read that if and when you get it out there.
If you win.
When there's another element of this, as you can tell, there's like an interest on my behalf of you sitting between the timeless and the internet culture. The other element of that, or kind of manifestation of that, that I'm interested in is you both have an incredible eye for the timeless content, but you're also very good at memes. How do you think about those as like, I don't know if it's like complementary art forms or whether there's actually like an underlying shared skill set for them, but you partake in both. So how do you think about the use of memes moving forward and how that kind of plays into your arsenal?
Yeah, well, I don't, the memes thing is funny because don't think of myself in that. What's like, I don't even think about them, you know, the return investment with memes is very little for me psychologically. It's like, if I write a Substack that gets 30 likes, that's brilliant. If I do a meme, it gets like, you know, 3,000 likes. I don't feel anything. I maybe feel something if it gets zero, but when it does well, and often I'm just trying to, it's often there's kind of a meta memery going on where there'll be a prevalent meme and then I'll try and pull it back to kind of what I've become known for. So managed to like, you know, Dostoevsky memes have managed to kind of kick off on my Twitter somehow, which I wouldn't have expected. I'm getting tagged left and right on anything Dostoevsky related now. But that kind of, that paired with just reading him loads and then posting about him loads. So there's kind of like, you know, there's like come for the meme, stay for the quotes type thing.
I like that.
Which sends, I'm not going to put, sometimes I put out a meme just because it just makes me laugh a lot. But in general, I'm trying to tie it back to something and try and make it cohesive with the rest of it. So it doesn't seem, but I'll throw out a few oddballs because I just don't want to be pigeonholed into exactly what I have to tweet or how I have to tweet. But yeah, so there is kind of a method there that it kind of, it gets people kind of in a trance, but I guess something kind of like a rhythm where like, you know, they're enjoying a couple of memes, then a quote comes and they might actually stop and read it now because it's coming from the same place. It's the same name is there, like, you know, Fyodor is there. So it's like, and then, yeah, I could get loads of messages from people like, okay, so now saw your memes. Where do I start with the Dostoevsky oof?
Right.
Yeah.
It's so,
there is some return of it, but there.
Yeah. It's your own application of top of funnel marketing and your own niche. That makes more sense when put forth that way. On the topic of Dostoevsky and that, and you having kind of ownership of this meme of him throughout your own accounts, the most prevalent of which I think is more recent, is this concept of not lying to yourself. He has this quote, "Your worst sin is that you've destroyed and betrayed yourself for nothing," which, like, you've riffed on quite a bit recently. You've represented it in another way as well, which is memento. Is it? I'm not good with Latin. Is it mores or more? Memento more. Remember character.
I think mores.
Mores.
I don't know either. Yeah. I've Googled.
Never said it out loud. Yeah.
Yeah.
Perfect.
No, right.
But this concept of not lying to yourself is at the core of all of this, of authenticity, which is something I've been thinking a lot about myself. I think at the end of last year, I had said, like, the biggest realization I had was to figure out who you are and who you are not. Like, everything stems from that, and the realization of those things. And so not lying to yourself is another way of saying that. Why are so many people comfortable lying to themselves, and why aren't you, or why are you aspiring not to be?
It's impossible to know where the truth starts and the lying stops, because you don't know, okay, and now is this the bottom of the lies, or am I just at a new layer of it?
Right.
But I think, almost like mantrifying it and memifying it, it kind of keeping even like, way, like, you know, above all, don't lie to yourself in your head, or your worst sin is that you destroyed and betrayed yourself for nothing, which is my lock screen on my phone now. Just because I just thought it'd be funny. And so I just see it all the time. So it is like the memento mori, where, you know, it's just like, you know, but rather than death, it's kind of just to check yourself and don't, you know, watch your bullshit on like a daily basis. And then I think if you do that long enough, you'll gradually wear whatever kind of Jung called it, the dead wood that you need to burn away. It's kind of a disciplined way as opposed to an inspiration laden way of doing it. So you kind of, it's like a way through honesty chronically and gradually, as opposed to, like, you know, people that kind of say, I was even thinking about this the other day, it's like, yeah, I fix myself, or I'm working on myself. I bet if you ask, like, in what respect, you'd get zero response. It's just kind of something that you say in general. It's like, I should be better or something, but then you need to kind of specify it down. Yeah, and I think that's kind of where the meme resonates a bit, because people are like, fuck, I definitely lied on this up a bit as well. That's kind of where it's from.
It's a much more direct and effective form of self-improvement, I think, than like the kind of, the type of self-improvement that has proliferated and people buy into. This cuts a lot deeper. What you said, which I agree with, that you think you are still lying to yourself. You probably, maybe enlightenment is is when you stop lying to yourself. You opt out of the lies entirely. So we're probably going to keep lying to ourselves forever. What lie or lies are you currently wrestling with about yourself? What are the things you're trying to currently resolve? And we don't have to make it super personal if it's something about your work, for example.
Definitely lie to myself about time. I think I was saying a lot of the same things in my head at 28 that I was at 18, in respect to how long I had to get things done, how long I had full stop. And then all of a sudden a decade's gone by and you thought you'd be a lot further along. And I definitely think I'll be a lot further along at 38 than I probably will, unless I stop lying to myself about that kind of thing. Even like later, you know, little things about, you know, again, I'm living in Spain, so the mañana mentality. So, like, a lot of times, I'll go to the gym tomorrow. but I need to go today. I was like, no, fuck, just do it today. And you know, you won't, because you said that yesterday.
Right.
And especially with writing as well. So it's like, you know, yesterday you said you'd write tomorrow and today you're saying the same thing. So you, again, this kind of perpetual, very, very white lie that no one needs to know about, that only you know about. And I think that those ones are almost the most cancerous. It's like, you know, these constant, even though, God forbid, to quote Conor McGregor, but he just said, like, you know, that voice in your head. So when you say you will do something, even to yourself, if you start betraying and destroying yourself, these little times, they don't go away because they're small. It's a cumulative thing, and it's an internal rot, which I think is worse than even lying to someone else, especially over time.
I know we're coming up on time. I'm going to throw out two kind of rapid fire listing questions, meaning your responses will be lists. You had said, you tweeted out the other day, which coincidentally I had the same experience when I went into a bookstore, was just like your desire to have your own bookstore where you can curate your own works. You walk into most bookstores and they are, to your earlier point about kind of pandering to the present, to the ephemeral. There aren't, at least in smaller bookstores, this timelessness to them. So if you're given the money to start your own bookstore, what are the 3 to 5 books that you're putting out in the window that are getting featured for passerbys?
We'll go Brothers Karamazov. We will go Yak Pangsep, The Archaeology of Mind, which is, I went down a, like a evolutionary neurobiology rabbit hole like 10 years ago. And that's just, I go back to it all the time. Just changed how I thought about, you know, the origins of emotion and all this kind of thing. It's incredible. I will say Colin Wilson's The Outsider. Because it's one of my dad's favorite books and it's one of mine. And it goes again and again. It's like talking about the secluded artist within culture. Mm. So it kind of resonates with me a lot. And the necessity of solitude. So that's what? That's 2 nonfiction, 1 fiction. I'll go Borges Ficción. And I'll go to finish Golden Contemporary. You go Ian McGilchrist, The Master and His Emissary.
Oh, not his more recent work. I was just listening to
it's a really recent for me, but to be honest, they're pretty close. The Matter with Things, maybe a 3 book set.
Yeah, probably go together. I haven't read Master and the Emissary, but I was listening to a talk between McGilchrist and Verbeke the other day that is like still ringing around in my head. So I need to go. I started The Matter with Things, but it's long and dense. So hoping I'll make my way through it over time. I was joking to myself that I could either read this or the Bible. So in the interest of timelessness, not sure which one I should spend my time on. But that's
probably the Bible. The Bible's probably easier, to be honest.
Right. Funny enough. All right, that's a great window. We'll see if Jim O'Shaughnessy will fund that when you move out to Madrid, that bookstore. All right, so the second listing question here, as a film aficionado, this one circulated. There's a film account that I follow that I'm sure you do too on Twitter. This made its rounds a few months ago. Who are your 3 favorite directors? And your 3 favorite films of theirs?
Favorite directors? It tends to be film by film. Because a lot of directors that, like, you know, like Wim Wenders, I really like Paris, Texas. But then a lot of like Coppola stuff would be ahead of Wim Wenders' other stuff.
That's the difficulty of the question.
But that's an example. Yeah. So I'll go Wim Wenders, I would go Richard Linklater. I think I'll always watch a Richard Linklater film, especially the early stuff, Waking Life. I love that movie. The Before Sunset, Before Sunrise, those movies are great. And then I'll go Terry Jones. Directed a lot of the Monty Python.
Awesome.
The directorial work isn't necessarily the feature there, but yeah, just Monty Python in general.
Great. Okay. We've got a lot of content recommendations coming out of this episode. Awesome. Well, I know we're at time. I appreciate you, sir. I know it's a little bit later for you as well. The final question, which maybe I kind of primed you with this a few moments ago, but I was asked guests the same question, which is to flip it back around on you. What's one question you'd leave me and listeners with, whether to think about or act on?
Are you lying to yourself?
Yeah, I thought it was going to be that, or what are you lying to yourself about? So we're on the same page there. I think
it's, that's probably true. Yeah, how much are you lying to yourself? Something like that.
Yeah, perfect. Awesome. Well, thank you, sir. It's been a blast.
Thank you.
As always, I feel like you and I could talk for hours, and we'll talk soon.